Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That's a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Kimberly King Parsons, author of We Were the Universe, a novel centering a young mother, Kit, in denial after the death of her sister. Kit navigates the dizzying landscapes of desire, guilt, and grief in what is ultimately a really enjoyable romp and a fearless exploration of sisterhood, motherhood, friendship, marriage, psychedelics, and the many strange, transcendent shapes love can take. Kim, thank you so much for joining me to talk about We Were the Universe. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
We Were the Universe is the story of Kit, the young mother of Gilda, an almost four-year-old. And when we enter Kit's life, she is beginning to come to terms with her sister's death, which happened when she was pregnant with Gilda nearly 4 years prior. And I want to talk about the novel's structure. It's in the first-person perspective, from Kit's perspective. It's in the present tense. It's a very internal first person, really focusing on Kit's interiority. And all of this is punctuated by flashback-like segments, by her memories. Kim, how did you come to this structure, focusing so closely on or within Kit, and then kind of using these flashbacks to create depth of memory and time?
Yeah, well, so actually the way that I came to the structure was because I knew that I was writing a book about grief. And for me, the way that I have experienced grief in my life is that it's the sensation that you are not in the present moment at all. And so even though I set the book in first person present tense in this very interior way, I wanted to show a character who was constantly being jerked backwards into the past. The past becomes very dangerous, actually, when you are a person who's grieving, if you're trying not to think about the person that you've lost. And there are triggers everywhere. You know, it could be something you overhear in a conversation or a color or, you know, just an object that you see, and you're immediately propelled backwards into the past. And so I wanted to capture that sensation of both the way that that grief consumes the present moment and the way that the past becomes both very dangerous, but also kind of a weird release from the present moment. So we see Kit at, you know, the playground, at gymnastics class, and she kind of has two methods. It's either that she's going to revert to the past or she's going to revert to fantasy. But either way, she's having a really hard time being in the present moment, even though the book itself is set in the present tense.
And not only does this structure complicate or really spotlight this confusion of time that grief causes people, but it also sort of fits with kind of like the tedium of mothering a small child, how the minutes can creep by, but they grow up so fast, how, you know, all-encompassing caretaking for a small child can be, that it kind of causes all the other elements of one's life, in Kit's case, the death of her sister, to kind of be backburnered. And I presumed, Kim, that this is why the novel takes place 4 years after Julia's death. Will you talk about that choice and why you've kind of begun the novel in this place specifically?
Yeah. So, I mean, there when Kit loses Julie when she's pregnant, and she is immediately still has to be a mom in that moment. And she's a young mom. It's an unexpected pregnancy. And she kind of has to rise to the occasion. And she does. And she is a very dedicated caregiver in many ways because she herself was underparented. She doesn't want to make the same mistakes that her mother did. So there's nothing like a newborn to distract you from your pain. And so for the first few years of Gilda's life, this seems to be working, this sort of the hyper-focus on the present moment, which is what you have to be with a child, even that hyper-vigilance of keeping them safe in the world. But now Gilda is starting to get a little bit more independence, and she's almost four. She is starting to sort of venture out on her own in many ways, and she's not, Kit's not as needed in Gilda's life. And so that coping mechanism, just this hyper-focus on her child, is starting to shift a little bit. And so we start to see the way that that is no longer going to be an effective distraction for Kit. People always say when you have a baby, you know, oh, enjoy every moment. And the days are so long, but the years are so short. And all of this has just been one huge distraction from this really important psychic work that Kit needs to do of processing pain and guilt surrounding the death of her sister. She just hasn't done it yet. And that's largely because she's been so focused on Gilda.
She also is of the personality, and I don't necessarily know how to phrase this, but she is seeing a therapist, but this person is a quote-unquote sliding scale therapist. And Kit feels the need to lie to this person about certain ideas or aspects of her life. Like, what impulse are you following when you wrote that particular aspect of Kit's character, that she is so interior and yet unwilling to kind of let someone who is supposed to kind of dive into that interiority with her, she kind of refuses to let him in. She's so bored with therapy.
Yeah, she's going through the motions in the same way. It's similar to the way that she parents, actually. She's going through the motions of being a good therapy patient. She's showing up. She's tried all these other things. She's done a float tank. She's done meditation. She's attempted to heal. And yet she is not actually engaging with the part of herself that she needs to in order to heal. And in the same way that, you know, she's following attachment parenting to the letter, but yet she feels kind of disconnected from her daughter, disconnected from everyone around her because of what is just under the surface with all of this pain and guilt inside. And so I think that it's something that I have thought about a lot, is that when you lose someone, the grief is often something that you cling to in many ways, because it's like there's a sense that if you're still in pain, you're still experiencing the loss at its highest, you know, capacity. And I think that for a lot of people, the idea of quote unquote moving on is not something that they really actually want to do. And even though she's in therapy, she's trying to do these things because she knows that she does need to, and it has been many years. I think she's still clinging to that because she just doesn't feel ready to do it. And two, because I think she worries that if she lets go of some of that guilt and pain, that she will be letting go of her sister.
Hmm. This is a separate question about time, or the way that you've written time through a different lens or through object. But I'm curious about the way that you've written about pop culture. It's like a lack of naming the thing that you're talking about. You write about an app that a reader might read as Grindr, but you don't necessarily name it Grindr. You write about a coffee shop, a donut shop, all these places that a reader will know specifically what you're speaking to. And this feels like an attempt to kind of circumnavigate anachronism in your work, maybe. And I'm curious about how you think about time and maybe relevance. Like, are you thinking about that when you're writing? When you're writing, you don't want to name these things because you don't want to place your book in a specific era or time?
Yeah, I think I'm trying to stretch the era a bit, like where, yeah, a reader's going to know, oh, well, this is Grindr. There's also the opportunity for inventiveness, right? So when I rename something, it's mine. It's not just me using Grindr. It becomes a part of the world of the book. So there's that. But then also, I think saying like the donut place instead of saying like Dunkin' or Dunkin' Donuts, like these also become very regional. Like I'm sure that if you're in Boston, you would say Dunkin'. But I'm trying to also be a little bit more encompassing for the types of readers that I might find, both in time and geography, experience, class, because all of those things are different and every reader brings their own set of them to the book. And then often it's an issue of sonics, where I just don't like the name of something. I don't like what it's called. And so I want to change it to make it better suit the rest of the sentence syntactically for my purposes. So sometimes I'll do it that way. And then other things I like, and I'll let them come in as they are. So there are certain brand names or things that sneak in. It's really about the sentence, honestly. Like everything is to the loyalty of like what's going to make this sentence the best, the most crystalline version that it can be. And so I'm constantly making those choices. But then, yeah, I am aware of not wanting to write a book about, you know, Facebook, and then, you know, in 10 years, it just feels so dated. And even though I realize that the novel is a container of our time period, it can be, I like to play around with it and get a little bit more time out of it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love that you're hyper-focused on the sentence. Of course, like as a writer, one might presume that's the case, but I think you specifically write with a hyper specificity that I don't see in a lot of novelists. And one of the very distinct joys of your novel for me was reading about these very specific aspects of each character, the way Gilda would pretend to wash her hands after she went to the bathroom, how Julie would swipe her feet under the covers. I'm wondering, do you look to other authors who do this really well, or do you encounter those authors elsewhere?
I am really pulling those types of details are coming from real life, or they're coming from voice stuff again, where I do think it's possible. My dad used to rub his feet over each other in bed at night. And I just remember being on like family vacations or something and being in the room and being like, what is that sound? And realizing it was just him rubbing his feet over each other. But those things, like when you're a noticer, when you're paying attention, which is what I think is absolutely critical to the kind of writing that I want to read anyway. I want precise details. And so you create a voice, you create a character, and then you can drop little details, little like Easter eggs from real life into those characters. And I find that to be one of the great pleasures of writing, actually, is you build a character and then they can suddenly have your father's feet, you know, amazing. But I love those moments. And I think it's really about, I'm always, again, like looking for the weird thing, looking for the tilted thing. So I don't find it that much in literature, honestly. It's hard because I think it comes from real life experience, because often I think sometimes there's a tendency to write to the middle in literature. So it would be like when someone's falling asleep at night and they would turn on their side and pull the covers up. Like it's just something that we are familiar with. And what I'm really interested in is the strange, the unfamiliar, or the thing that feels very particular to one person. And I think that you have to just be, you have to create a character who's also paying attention really, really closely. And so all of these characters are synthesized through Kit's perspective. And Kit's perspective is so strong that we know that these are the types of details she would notice and that she would pay attention to. So that hyper-specificity is not just for the secondary characters. It's actually, it all emanates from the primary character, from our protagonist. It's just the way that she views the world. And so I'm always writing about characters who are noticers, who are paying attention, because that's where, to me, all of the pleasure is found in those weird little details.
While you were talking, I couldn't help but think, like, well, if Kit is noticing all of these things, what are those around her noticing about Kit? And, you know, we've already talked about this idea that we're really closely following her internal dialogue here. And I don't think that it's too much of a giveaway to say, and I'll ask you to explain your impulse then, to turn the novel's perspective at the end, to pivot from this really close first-person internal dialogue of Kit to Julie's perspective in the last chapter. What was that impulse? What were you hoping that would accomplish?
Well, I knew, again, you know, we write this character, I'm writing this character who's very internal. It's this sense of almost a claustrophobic interiority throughout the whole book. And so now you have an option at the end. You can either continue along the same path or you can really flip it. And so this was a moment to flip it. And it was also this moment to get magic in the book in a way that I don't ever tilt fully into magical realism. Like it's to be interpreted by the reader, whether or not Kit is actually being visited by Julie or if she's really participating in some sort of, beyond the grave interaction. But I knew that if I flipped that ending and we gave Julie a voice just briefly, that we would suddenly get a whole new perspective on the entirety of the rest of the book. And even on Kit's viewpoint of herself, she certainly believes she's the worst person in this book. And when we see the role flipped at the end, we just briefly get to see the way that that Kit looked to Julie, and how Kit is a big sister and she's capable, and we get to see her in this different way. But we also get to see the exact same scene that we've seen in the middle of the book from a different perspective. And I'm fascinated by mirrors and portals and the way that these scenes are connecting to each other through the book. And I had the ending actually very early on in the process. And my editor was like, this is absolutely the right ending. We just have to justify it. Like, we just have to get there. He's like, it's so weird. I want us to pull it off. It's so crazy. And I love it because it's one of those things that people have written to me about the ending. And I know there's a lot of people who will read some of the book and not read the whole book, but I always know who's read the whole book because they're like, I had no idea it was going to shift perspective. Or when people are like, it's the whole book is told in Kit's perspective. I'm like, oh, they didn't get to the last part, which is totally fine. But I do feel like that surprise, both a structural surprise for the reader, but also Julie's voice is completely different than Kit's voice. Her syntax is different. Her language, her choices are so different. And I think it hopefully, you know, it just takes a second to realize, oh, we're in someone else's head. And then you really quickly realize that we are revisiting a scene that was really important.
You're listening to A Conversation with Kimberly King Parsons. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Montana Book Company, located in downtown Helena, Montana, since 1978, offering new books for all ages, vinyl records, and community activism. Delivery in Helena and shipping online at mtbookco.com. This novel takes place in Texas and in Montana, two really, you know, geographically massive states. And yet there seems to be a real economy of setting. Will you speak to the role that place has in this story, but also in your writing process?
Yeah, I am very attuned to this idea of the economy of imagination, meaning that when we're creating a space, in this case, the neighborhood where the neighborhood of, like, her physical neighborhood where Kit lives, but also the sort of neighborhood of her imagination, just this the places in her mind, she's continuously revisiting similar places. So, you know, I think sometimes people, they write a novel and it's almost like there's 100 locations and, like, the characters bouncing all over the country geographically. And there's certainly that is a type of writing, right? There's something that happens there. But for me, what I'm most interested in is this idea that when we revisit a similar place, so even if that's a place that no longer exists, like a place in the past, like this pink rug, which becomes very significant over the course of the book, you know, I could have written that, you know, five different scenes of these sisters and their psychedelic experiments in the past, and they could have happened in all different places. But when you're locking them into a setting, when you're using economy of setting, what happens is you get this accumulation. So the first time I describe it, you have these details. And the next time, I don't have to describe it from the beginning. I can just pick and choose, add a couple more things. We get the sense of a rich world. And that's a rich world of the past. It's a rich world of this neighborhood in the present. We're returning to the same park bench, the same coffee shop. And so it starts to create this sense that there's a reality. There's a real space there. Because in our real life, we are in, you know, a few settings. We're not actually bouncing around all the time. I mean, I don't know. I'm not. I definitely am tethered in my way, you know, to my life. And so I wanted to write a character who was also tethered in a similar way, but also even in her imagination, she's tethered as well.
I love that. I love that. You mentioned psychedelics, this idea that Kit and Julie, they have quite a psychedelic, I guess, adolescence. They dabble in drugs. And you return, or Kit returns, to these moments in flashback, in memory. I'm wondering why you leaned into psychedelia, I guess, or psychedelics in the way that you have. What did that provide for you, for the characters, that allowed you to propel the novel in the way that you wanted to forward?
So I think it would be impossible to sort of separate this out from my own personal experience, honestly. And so for myself in my real life, I've had a number of really positive formative experiences with psychedelics that to me feel nothing short of magic. It's something that has changed the way that I view the world, the way that I view myself. And I'm constantly wanting to return to that place, even though I'm not a person who uses psychedelics anymore. But I see these, like, bright spots in my adolescence, and they were often due to psychedelic experiences. And so there's that. But there's also this sense that Julia and Kit are connected in a sort of transcendent way, even before they ever use drugs. There's a moment where the two of them are in their bedroom and they sort of have a shared hallucination that is completely, they're completely sober. And this idea of having a transcendent connection with a person, I love it. I think it's fascinating. It's something that I'm always gravitating towards. But I think that psychedelics can sometimes be a shortcut to show you those connections. I also love this idea that psychedelics show you what's already there. It's not that it's inventing something new or it's something that's made up. It's just showing you all of these beautiful, glorious connections that are already existing in the space. And so I'm always looking in all of my work for something that's either above reality or below reality, something that's a little tilted or skewed about perspective. And of course, psychedelics are a really quick way to get you to that place.
Was it important for you to make clear to the reader in the space of the novel, in this specific time that the readers are encountering Kit, was it important for you to make clear that because she was a mother or because she was married or whatever, her circumstances of her life in this moment, that she doesn't really partake in psychedelics anymore?
I just knew that she didn't personally. Like, because I knew a lot, I mean, she could have been a mom who participates in psychedelics, she could be in an open marriage, she could have a lot more freedom in her life, but she doesn't. And I think that's because she has chosen this particular path because for a reason. And so I did want to show that it's just specific to Kit. It's not necessarily like this idea of, you know, Kit knows, Kit doesn't judge other mothers, this idea of like, well, if some other mom wanted to go and have a weekend and do a bunch of mushrooms, she wouldn't have a problem with that. But I think that for Kit, she feels that her grasp on these sort of conventional roles is, it needs to be a little bit tighter. And perhaps that's because of the way that she was parented and this idea that she could potentially, and also just addiction in her family, this idea that she could potentially spin out or lose control. So she is holding on to these things rather tight. And so, yeah, I think that that's a big part of it. And she's certainly not talking about, yeah, microdosing, you know, this idea of like, you know, having like little tinctures, or she's like talking about these huge formative experiences. But it's also that that ship has sort of sailed for her. I don't think that she could do these drugs now. She you know, ponders this. What if I just did LSD to conquer my fear of doing LSD? You know, maybe it would help me. But I think that the ship has just sailed for her because she's in a very different phase of her life at this point.
And from a craft perspective or like authorial perspective, having those boundaries for her allows her kind of flights of fancy, her fantasy, her memories to be all the more fantastic, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I love an obstruction always in fiction. So I'm always looking for, well, what are the rules? And the rules for this character are that she can't do these things. She won't allow herself to do these things, but also she still has such fondness for them. And then the other huge part of this book, I think, is longing. I mean, you get it in the title. We were the universe. We aren't anymore. And she was this magical, sparkling, psychedelic wonder in her teen years, and she's not anymore. Those days are over. But there's no better way to capture that sort of longing and nostalgia than to put a boundary around what is allowed.
When you're writing a character like Kit or just a novel like We Were the Universe, are those rules that you spoke of, are those put in place at the beginning when you're conceptualizing the story? Or are you kind of butting up against these, as you call them, obstacles, or not meeting those obstacles and needing to put those obstacles in their way to propel the tension in the story?
So everything to me is voice. And so every rule, every obstacle, every obstruction, it all comes from syntax. It all comes from grammatical choices that the narrator is making. And so they tell me who they are. They tell me about themselves. They tell me what they're looking for, what their class is, what they allow, what their history is. And so I start to get this sense of, well, these are the things that Kit would participate in or she wouldn't participate in. So she's telling me the rules, and the rules are coming just at the sentence level. And then once the rule is revealed to you, then you can either refute the rule, or you can continue to carry the rule through, or you can continue to carry it through to a certain point and then refute it later. But yeah, so I'm always just hyper aware of what that voice is telling me that it wants. And so there's no sense of like, I set out to write a book about a mom and who is living in the past. And these are like, I never have any idea of what I'm writing. It always just comes at that really granular level, which is really painstaking and slow, but it's just the way that I've always written. And it's always worked for me. It's never led me astray. I've always been really, I feel like the rules will come to you if you're just paying attention to the sentence, to the sentences themselves.
Mm-hmm. I do want to give you the opportunity to speak to something in your book that we haven't yet talked about or something peripheral. I want to give you space to talk about that now if you have it.
Sure. I mean, I guess something that I just want to say is that obviously when you write a book, there's this whole team of people involved, like professional people, your editor and your agent, your publicist and that stuff. But I also just, I am so grateful for this group of writer friends in my life and the way that being able to sort of digest the daily work with other people from the outside. And I don't even mean my writing group. Like I'm talking about people who've never read a word of my project, but who are also working on their own projects. And it's just this group of women who we come together and talk about sort of the day, like the wins of the day, the losses of the day. And I just value them so much. And I appreciate their work so much. And they're writers and they have books coming out as well. And I just I just think you can't underestimate how important it is to have a sense of community in a profession that otherwise feels very isolating in many ways. And you're sitting in your room working on something for 5 years, but it's so nice to have these people that I can check in with, even in an abstract way, maybe especially in an abstract way, because we're not talking about the work itself or the choices. We're talking about the feeling around the work, which is often about, I feel like the biggest thing is being able to come to the page with a sense of self-worth. Like, I can do this. I'm meant to do this. I'm the only person who can tell this story, and this story is supposed to be told. And this is the biggest obstacle for a lot of my students or clients that I work with who are trying to make their way through a first draft. It's just that sense of, who cares? Like, why am I doing this at all? And it's so great to have somebody waiting on the other side or somebody who's there at the end of every day that you can sort of check in with. And it's accountability sometimes. So it's like, I'll text with my friend Chad before we start and we'll just leave voice memos, or sometimes we'll talk on the phone, but it's like, I was trying to write this scene and it was a disaster. It didn't work, but I don't know specifics. And it's not a workshop, because I feel like a workshop starts to get you into these realms of aesthetic choices, which is that I would have made a different choice than the choice that you're making here. Or let me solve this for you. When we all know, ultimately, the only person who can solve any of our problems is ourselves. Like, that's it. You're the only one. And you really are, in many ways, responsible for every single aspect of it. I always think of writing a novel as it's like a dream. You're every character in your dream. You're every object. You're everything. You're every color, every sound. It's all you. And that's the same way in a novel. No one can really tell you what to do. You have to just try to get as close to that vision in your mind as you can. But I love this idea of having a group of people who you can just be like, today was so bad. Today was terrible. Everything I wrote was terrible today. And that you can have someone who's like, you know what? I actually had a pretty good day, and it actually feels good to be like, well, there is good. There is, it's possible, or to have, you can both commiserate. Like, we had really bad days today, but it's okay because tomorrow will be better. But just that sense that we're all doing the daily work, which ultimately, when all of this other stuff is stripped away, it's just like, how was the work today?
That was Kimberly King Parsons, author of We Were the Universe, out now in hardcover from Knopf and available in paperback from Vintage Books this June, 2025. To listen to this conversation again, to share it with friends, or to learn more about Kim, head to mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.